Hey, welcome to KSL Plus, the digital-only newscast where we dive deep into some of the biggest issues of the day. So after every natural disaster, pandemic, or other traumatic event, there are ripples felt for generations. The Black Plague, for example, led to the rise of workers' rights. The Spanish flu was a catalyst behind modern architecture, apartments with radiators to keep a unit warm, even if the windows are open to allow fresh air in, units with private bathrooms, not shared, and wide communal hallways. The Spanish flu put many European countries on the path to centralized medicine. World War II inspired our own employer-based insurance. Young adults graduating college this year won't remember ever going to the gate to pick someone up at the airport. Most were just infants on 9/11. And of course, we can't forget what's happening right now. The families of 2.6 million people around the world who lost their lives to COVID, and countless more who have been impacted financially, mentally, or physically. But what changes will we see 5, 10, 20, 100 years down the road that will trace back to the year 2020 and COVID? 1 year in, we're looking at changes to healthcare specifically that will likely stick around as we head into what many call our new normal. We spoke to Dr. Russell Vinnick, the Chief Medical Operations Officer for University of Utah Healthcare, and Dr. Patrick Carroll, Intermountain's St. George Regional Hospital Medical Director. Here are a few changes they hope or expect are here to stay.
I think that we all have been a little bit more cognizant of our activities and our interactions with each other and the impact that potentially could have on spread of disease. As we move forward, I hope those are lessons that we don't forget. We have seen a dramatic decrease in influenza this year. We have seen a dramatic decrease in respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, among children. Our pediatric volumes, inpatient volumes, have dramatically decreased. The volumes of patients here in St. George with our pediatric unit are considerably lower than previous winters. And that's a great thing. So how do we take the lessons and move forward? I'd like to see us, and I hope we can be in a situation where we get the best of both worlds, where we get back to not needing to wear masks, and I do believe we're getting there. However, when I'm sick, when my family member's sick, when my neighbor is sick, to reinforce that it is okay. It's all right to wear a mask. In fact, it's encouraged to wear a mask to prevent spread of respiratory viruses. And if we can do that, we may be able to have the majority of people not wearing masks and a minority. There are countries in the world that have been doing this for a very long time and doing it successfully. I hope we've taken some of the stigma away from wearing masks when you're feeling a little bit under the weather, and preventing spread of that to other people.
This flu season, the U.S. saw one pediatric flu death, where we usually see around 200. Experts say that shows hand washing, staying home when you're sick, and wearing masks really help and can help in the future. They mentioned advancements in medical research and the way doctors and scientists share their findings and the way we consume that information.
mRNA vaccines and adenovirus vector vaccines, those have been around for decades or more, but they haven't really hit prime time. Now they've proven very well, and in part because of the significant time and effort and money that's gone into the COVID research, they've been able to prove both of these as reliable ways to create vaccines. And so the potentials are so broad, not just in treating other diseases or infections or viruses, but also cancers, for example. There's quite a few different cancer vaccine trials that are underway where you can literally cause one's own immune system to attack cancer cells better. And that gets a bit complicated, but having proven this technology is going to go a long way to expedite treatment for many different diseases, cancer probably being highest on the list.
What we saw was a scientific community worldwide that really came together and in rapid fashion came up with answers to a lot of those questions. And we continue to hone those answers and learn more. But one of the big takeaways that I've seen is the public, I think, has been able to see medicine and science in action. And that's been, I think, at times frustrating for people because that's led to changing recommendations, you know, from 1 week to the next or 1 month to the next. I think that's been confusing for people early on, but it's important for people to see that happening because that's how science works. And that's how we learn and make some pretty quick changes. So, you know, one of the takeaways I'd like to see is that we, the general public, have a better understanding of medical developments, scientific progress, and see how we can make changes on the fly for better care and better prevention. Doing it for many, many years. They're the expert. Can I learn how to change my oil? Can I learn how to do a few things on my car? Certainly. Am I going to be at the same level as that mechanic? I'm not. Not without hours and hours and hours, and truly probably years of experience. The same is true for probably every profession. And so one of the challenges that I think we face in this information age is trying to identify which information is accurate information and which is not accurate information. And more, I think what we're seeing is individuals, and I think we're all guilty of this. I'm certainly guilty of this, reading information in a particular area and feeling like we have, feeling like we're an expert, feeling like we're, you know, we have as much information as much as the person that's truly dedicated their life to that specialty or to that area. And so as we do that, as we move forward, I think what we need to do is identify ways that experts can be identified as experts, and those that are not experts certainly, you know, can and should have a voice. We've got to, you know, ways that can happen, but to identify themselves as an interested party, not necessarily as an expert. So it's a big opportunity, and I think, Shelby, that's why we've seen more and more doctors in social media, whether that's, you know, Facebook or YouTube or Instagram or whatever news outlets, being more vocal. Historically, that didn't happen as often. Historically, physicians, really, communication was through academic medical journals and academic scientific conferences. But because the information, because there are so many people sharing information that are not experts, I think it's incumbent upon us as medical experts to be more available, to be more vocal, to share that information so that there's not a vacuum of accurate and reliable information from reliable sources. So we as a profession, I think, have to take that on and make sure that we're being appropriately transparent and visible with information.
And of course, healthcare providers' mental health is at the forefront of their minds.
Most of us physicians, we can handle anything for a week or two or a few weeks. We trained and worked 80, 100-hour weeks routinely, and some of us still do. But to do that for months and months on end, and the mental toll that takes on our staff, is something that we really have to think through for the future. How do you prepare for that?
You may have seen we had an in-depth conversation about that a few weeks ago. You can find that episode on KSLTV.com/KSLplus. That's KSLPLUS, and on the KSLTV app. But there was one big change both doctors brought up.
Telehealth.
Telemedicine.
Our KSL Plus producer Shelby sat down with Carrie Pelicanis, the Intermountain Connect Care Executive Director, to see how telehealth is growing and what it could mean for marginalized communities.
Okay, let's start broadly. How much was telehealth and Connect Care being used pre-pandemic, and how has that grown in the last year?
The growth is very hard to measure. The numbers are so large, it's crazy when you talk about it. But I'll give you an example of where we were with just video visits at Intermountain. Prior to the pandemic, we were struggling to do about 10 video visits for basically a provider to call their patient in their home environment or in a non-clinical setting. We were doing about 10 a week. And then in the height of the pandemic, we were up to about 6,000 to 7,000 per week. So we rapidly scaled from that 10 to the 6,000 to 7,000. We had a just shy of about 100 providers in our system that were trained in doing telehealth before the pandemic. Now, almost the entirety of our 2,500 plus providers have access to telemedicine now and telehealth. And so we went from not even hitting the mark of a percentage of provider visits that occur being telehealth to where now we average around 15% of all of our visits with patients occur through a telehealth environment. During the very height of the pandemic, that was up to close to 50%.
Wow. I knew it was going to be a dramatic increase, but that's beyond drastic. I don't even think there's a word to describe it.
Well, especially to somebody like me, I've been working in telehealth for 15 years. And so I described this to somebody yesterday. I spent the better part of my career in telehealth explaining to people what telehealth was. And it hit me last weekend when the Golden Globes did a joke telehealth visit with the stars and their doctors that I no longer have to explain to people what telehealth is. It's now the norm. And I would have never thought that would happen in the speed that it happened. I definitely knew the capabilities because that was my area of expertise. But, you know, it's just been delightful for those of us in telehealth to finally say, see, I told you this was going to happen and this is going to work. So, yeah, it's been fun.
Yeah, that was definitely one of my favorite parts of the show as well. It was just this communal experience that we all get it right now.
Well, and for me, I flash back to, 10 years ago where I stood in front of the Baltimore Society of Medicine and tried to explain what telemedicine was to them. And, you know, you would have thought I was describing unicorns. And, you know, would I have said, oh, yeah, 10 years from now on the Golden Globes, there's going to be this joke skit about telehealth? No, but, you know, that's just, so I say now I no longer have to explain it to the patients. Now I just have to help providers learn how to utilize the system appropriately and effectively.
So that kind of goes into my next question. I know we've talked about how helpful this is for patients, but how has it been for providers? I know I had a telehealth appointment a few months ago, and my doctor was also seeing me from home. We were both in our rooms talking to each other. So how has that changed? Kind of the way providers work, especially in clinical settings where you're just going in for a checkup.
Yeah. And again, you know, I come from a jaded perspective because I was doing it. I'm a nurse practitioner. I was doing a hybrid environment for many years when I was building telehealth. But really, there's a lot of uniqueness to being able to see a patient in an environment different from a clinic. If somebody's in their home setting, I could ask you right now, can you take me to your medicine cabinet? And you could show me what's actually in your medicine cabinet instead of trying to remember what's in it. You know, we could talk about what over-the-counter medicines you're taking as well as prescription medicines. I could ask you to take me to your bathroom and look for fall risks. And so I get a window into the true environment around you when I do telehealth, especially when you're in your home environment. Or sometimes, even if you're not in your home, you know, asking questions about, okay, you know, so where are you today and why are you there? Is it, you know, is it a situation of homelessness, a safety issue? There's just so many different aspects involved with what we can do with telehealth. But I think the most important part is we get to see the patient where they are when they need to be seen versus the patient having to meet our needs and our environment. From a provider standpoint, I think it's an incredibly great quality of life. Especially, you know, some people do telehealth from their office environment. But, you know, if you can do it from home, even better. I have about 30 ConnectCare urgent care providers that work 100% from home. And, you know, we cover 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And these folks are actually in multiple states around us. They're not even necessarily in Salt Lake. And so we're looking more and more now at workforce development with telehealth. You know, how could we provide jobs to people in rural and remote areas where jobs don't exist, but use them as telehealth opportunities? So I think more and more you're going to see that everybody from the doctor down looking at how can we utilize telehealth effectively to reach people in areas that otherwise would be difficult to reach and in environments that are different, like schools, community centers, things that, you know, employer-based clinics that we can now man through telehealth and provide coverage through.
Yeah, I just keep thinking about all of the implications of this. For me personally, I use a wheelchair, and transportation is something that, you know, I am very fortunate to have a lot of access to, but it's still difficult and can be hard. But if I can do an appointment via telehealth first, and there's a lot of times where it's like, do I need to go in? Do I need to get this checked? And be able to just do a telehealth appointment first and make a plan and say, oh, you know, you don't need to come in. Here's what you can do at home, or this is something that we need to see you in the office. And then I can make a transportation plan from there. But not having to worry about that right away is so beneficial.
And the physiologic effects of just being frustrated and trying to get to an appointment, even for somebody not in a wheelchair, you know, just taking time off of work, getting in your car, driving there, waiting in a waiting room with other sick people, you know, the exposure to other illnesses, there are so many positives to it. And I think that's one of the best things that came out of the pandemic was the fact that we were finally able to put telehealth in a variety of different environments into a variety of different patient populations. And I see more and more the patients asking the providers. I did that not too long ago myself when I went to see one of my providers, where I said, well, are you doing video visits? And they said, oh, not really. I'm thinking about it. And I go, oh, you're breaking my heart because it's my job. But aside from that, you know, let me tell you why you should do this. And it's just from the patient aspect, from the provider aspect, when you talk about people who need to have other caregivers involved in their care, you know, being able to have a video visit where you can, if you're an adult caring for your parent and you're at work, but you want to participate in a visit, or if you're a child where the parent is, one of the parents is at work and can't get off, but could video into the visit. There's so many opportunities available there.
And this has to have an impact on rural communities as well.
Yeah, we've been doing quite a bit of work in getting telehealth access out into central and southern Utah. And yes, you know, if you think about somebody in Blanding who needs to see a specialist at Primary Children's or Intermountain in Murray, you know, the amount of time, the cost, the frustration of having to travel into Salt Lake and back, especially this time of the year when you don't know if the roads are even going to be open. There's rural is where I came from, and the opportunities for access to care and opening up alternative accesses to care, because folks in rural environments, they just accept that they can't see a specialist, that there isn't a specialist in their town. And so sometimes they'll even not receive care because it's just too difficult to make those arrangements to get in, or they can't afford to get there. So what telehealth does is it allows anybody, regardless of where they live, to receive the same level of care as somebody who's living in an urban environment.
Within Utah, have you seen any challenges with people having access to internet, high-speed internet in these rural areas? And what about, among our population of people experiencing homelessness, what are some of the hurdles that you're seeing as telehealth becomes more available?
Definitely the country at large, when you get outside of urban areas, that internet access and broadband access is a problem. Now, the government has some programs to help address that, and they have been putting quite a bit of money into increasing broadband access in rural areas. But the good thing is that almost every rural environment I've ever worked in, and I've worked with quite a few, there's a library or a school that has broadband. And so it's one of the reasons why I get excited when I talk about school-based telehealth, how you can turn a school into a community center, a health center, by using telehealth. But more and more, the technology is also moving towards cellular-based technology. And cellular access is much more achievable than broadband access is at large. When we first started in telehealth, it was almost a requirement that you had broadband or internet because the bandwidth needed to be big enough. Now the technology has improved to where a patient can have a smartphone or a tablet and a device that's cellular enabled, and we're able to do the exact same thing.
I have a friend who, her grandparents live on the Navajo reservation, and they got water to their house 7 years ago, and that's in the United States. So I think there are so many areas where internet access is going to be spotty, and we just don't think about that. When does an audio call work over a video call? Is that a possibility as well for some of these rural areas that may have less access to high-speed internet?
Again, I'm somewhat biased here, so I will tell you that whenever I have the option of video, I take the video with the audio. But it, you know, you mentioned your friend on the Navajo Nation. I worked in rural Maryland, and I had patients who didn't have cell access at their home. The landline was all they had, and they didn't have internet or cell. So I'd take what I could get in that instance. But what video does to the audio is it enhances that. So if you're on the phone with somebody and they say, "I'm fine," you go, "Okay." They say they're fine. Whereas if I look at you and go, "I'm fine," you know, you get to see that the nonverbal, the facial expressions. And it just, it's like the difference between taking a photograph or seeing a movie of somebody. You know, you get that three-dimensional, four-dimensional approach to making that evaluation. And much of what we do in healthcare, it does come from our history taking and asking questions. So it's not that you can't use audio, but you know, the ability to be able to see somebody's body movements in relation to what they're saying and their facial movements. And like I said, also that whole external background, you know, looking at, I mean, mine's not very interesting today because I just painted my office, but you know, looking at what's in somebody's environment around them that you can't see on an audio, you know, you wouldn't have the access to in an audio visit.
Yeah, like I'm in my high school bedroom because I had to move back in with my parents during the pandemic. And so here we are.
See, these are the things that when I do a video visit, I love hearing,
right?
You know, because it's so interesting, especially when you have an established relationship with a patient where you see them regularly on video, where you go, "Hey, you look like you're someplace different today. Where are you and what's going on?" And you get to hear the background stories, and children are a blast to do video visits with because they just say anything.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that. You know, kids just want to show you their new toy. Whereas in a doctor's office, maybe they get kind of nervous. They don't say things. Whereas if they're home, you know, being on the computer is just like talking to grandma, and it can be a lot more comfortable and less intimidating.
Exactly. I mean, now for them, FaceTime is normal. You know, Zoom is normal. So I sometimes find that I have to get the parents comfortable with the platform, but the kids are great. They're like, "Oh, you know," they have smart boards in school. They learn off of an interactive technology in their school environment. And like I said, they're so much fun to do video visits with because they'll talk about anything in your environment as well as theirs. And, it's an incredibly interesting and useful technology, and what we can do to offer access to care to folks is what's most important about telehealth.
One question I did have as well, I called to set up a telehealth appointment a few months ago, and you know, things may have changed in the last few months, but the receptionist said, "Oh, what insurance do you have? We want to make sure that your insurance is still covering telehealth appointments." Is that changing? Are we seeing insurance companies now saying we're not going to cover this, or have they started to realize how beneficial this is?
Improving with time. And again, this is another thing that we can thank the pandemic for, because prior to the pandemic, insurance companies were very restrictive about where you could receive telehealth. And home wasn't considered a valid place to receive telehealth. You had to go to a clinic-like environment. So, you know, it was still somewhat helpful if you could go to a community health clinic and then have a telehealth visit with a specialist somewhere away. But the pandemic issued, the government issued a bunch of waivers, COVID waivers, that allowed us to expand telehealth access. And many of the insurance companies have followed suit with that during the pandemic. What will happen after 2021 is still a great debate, but I think there's enough movement, and not just among health insurance, health company, healthcare companies and providers, but among patients asking for continued access to care, that we should see a continuation of that. And more and more, there is adaption at the state and federal level for including telehealth as a method of delivery for healthcare.
Yeah, I know mine personally has been really great. They've added the 98.6 app to our coverage. And I have used that an embarrassing number of times, just in the middle of the night when I wake up and something doesn't feel quite right, and had some other issues. And so being able to open up that, talk to somebody and say, hey, do I need to go get this checked out? Can I wait till the morning? And they always say, you're fine, go back to sleep. But just having that peace of mind has been really helpful.
That's a great utilization of it, because otherwise you would have gone to an urgent care or an emergency room and had a very large bill, as would your insurance company. So you're reducing the cost of healthcare by using those types of apps. And we see that, and we track that with our Connect Care system as well. And yes, it's interesting now. So many of the insurance companies have bought telehealth practices like, you know, MD Live 98.6 or have partnered with them because they recognize the value of it.
Thanks so much for joining us on KSL Plus this week. Join us next week on the KSL TV app, the website, or Facebook page as we look at changes to businesses from childcare to working from home. See you later.